It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many U.S. workplaces required to report employee injuries to OSHA have not been doing that in recent years. We'll talk to an investigative reporter about making that kind of information public and what it all means for workers. First, a new documentary examines the potentially life-changing opportunities of a new gene editing technology called CRISPR. Human Nature is airing on PBS's science series Nova next Tuesday on PBS Wisconsin. That's September 15th at 7 and 11 p.m. And tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on Milwaukee PBS. The film explains the history behind CRISPR, which gives scientists the ability to alter DNA in a targeted way. CRISPR can change the parts of cells that cause genetic diseases, opening up the option of a potential cure for many patients. It also allows us to change other aspects of our DNA, reviving a debate about what science allows us to do and what we ought to do. Adam Bolt is director and writer of the new documentary Human Nature, which tackles the history, the science, and the ethics of CRISPR. Adam, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
And Alta Charo is a professor of law and bioethics at UW Law School. She is featured in that documentary. Alta, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Adam, a lot of people have heard a lot about CRISPR, this really exciting new technology. I learned from your documentary, from the microorganism perspective, this is a really prehistoric thing. That's part of the exciting story about this discovery, right? We found this in nature.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually billions of years old, so it's new as far as humans knowing about it, but it's existed in nature for a very long time. Over the past few decades, scientists became aware of it, figured out what it does, figured out how to harness part of it that can act as a sort of molecular scissors and cut DNA in a very targeted way, and they've turned it into a tool for gene editing.
And Adam, that targeting is the key part of this story. Before that, scientists could look at our genetic code, kind of know what did what, but when they tried to edit it, it was like, I don't know, trying to type on a keyboard wearing oven mitts. They couldn't necessarily make genes change where they want them. That was the big revolution of CRISPR, right?
That's right. It was possible in some circumstances to make targeted changes, but it was very expensive. It was very difficult. And it took many, many times longer. Something that, might have taken years before can be done in months or weeks with CRISPR.
I want to give a listen to the documentary with Jennifer Doudna, a biochemist at UC Berkeley, whose research into RNA helped lead to the discovery of CRISPR. Here's a listen.
It was clearly a useful tool, and initially I was thinking about it that way, right? Because, again, I'm a biochemist, right? I was thinking about it as a tool. I was thinking about all the cool experiments you could now do with this tool, right? I was thinking about that. I wasn't thinking about, oh, my gosh, I mean, this is a tool that... it fundamentally allows us to change our relationship with nature. It actually allows us to change human evolution if we want to.
Alta, can you explain a little more about the potential uses for this tool, this gene editing tool?
Sure. Interestingly, what people don't tend to talk about are the uses that will probably be the most common, and that's going to be agriculture. It's going to be changing plants so that they can resist drought or flood, or to change animals so that they don't produce as many greenhouse gases or waste that invades our environment. And that's probably where a lot of the money is going to be. But the big excitement for public discussion has been for human therapeutics. The film begins with the story of a young man with sickle cell, which is a terrible disorder that will shorten your life and be incredibly painful when you have sickle crises. But now with CRISPR, we're looking at the possibility of going into the human body, taking out cells that have genetic problems, treating them with this technique so that you can actually insert a normal version of the gene, and then putting the cells back in the body where they proliferate, and suddenly this person no longer suffers from sickle cell. That's one of the things that people are talking about. It's not just sickle cell, it's eye diseases, it's some cancers. These are already in clinical trials. The most controversial use, the one that's probably the least likely to be needed because other options exist, is to edit a human embryo when it's sitting outside the body if you've biopsied the embryo and discovered a terrible mutation that would be a disease when the child is born. But editing the embryo has enormous technical challenges that would have to be overcome before you'd even begin to think about whether you think it's a good idea or a bad idea, unethical or ethical to use it. So the one that everybody talks about, the designer babies, is the one that's probably the least important in terms of actual use.
You make an interesting point in the documentary, Alta. In effect, you say people are concerned that we might do horrible things with gene editing. You point out that we humans do horrible things of equivalent scales with the technology we already have. Gene editing might allow us to do them a little differently, but it doesn't add anything that new in some ways. Can you talk about that?
Well, it does add, what it adds is, as Adam was saying, is precision and ease. And so in a sense, you can ask, what are the ethical implications of efficiency? If something that was hard to do before is not in fact done very often, but now it becomes easy, does that mean you should anticipate that everybody's going to want to use it? So that's an ethical issue that arises only because things are simpler. The point I wanted to make in the film is simply that we've had over the last 50, 60 years, almost every decade, a new innovation that makes something easier in human reproduction that has the potential for abuse. Genetic screening of people for their carrier status. Then it was the screening of the actual fetus. Then it was the screening of the embryo. And along the way, also the ability to pick sperm donors or surrogates. And every one of these advances came with a fear that it would become so popular that we were going to start treating children as commodities, as in expect perfection, that we would no longer tolerate our spouses as imperfect as they are. And reassuringly, every one of those advances, which made those things easier, didn't actually result in those things. We tend to stick to things that are more emotionally satisfying.
We're talking go ahead.
I was going to say, my view is my hope is that we're going to have exactly the same experience with CRISPR.
Dr. Alta Charo, bioethicist at UW Law School, and Adam Bolt, director and writer of the new documentary, Human Nature. Adam, was this a complicated story to try to tell in a TV, a documentary format? Because this is some pretty technical material here.
Yeah, I mean, we spent over 3 years working on the film, and we also made our lives a little more difficult in that we chose not to use a narrator for the film. We really wanted the film to be told almost as kind of an oral history or something, like through the voices of the scientists and people like Alta Charo, who are, you know, looking at the ethical implications of this. We wanted it to be in their words, from their perspective, without a kind of voice of God coming in and telling you, you know, what to think. So that meant, you know, getting all of this stuff explained by the scientists who invented it, which was a challenge. But luckily we had an incredible artist to bring the world of CRISPR and DNA and all this stuff that happens inside the cell with this technology to bring it to life in a really incredible way.
Alta, we've talked to you in the past about setting ethical guidelines and in some cases legal guidelines for the use of technologies like this. Who out there in the world is getting together and trying to make the decisions that are going to guide what scientists and governments and corporations can do with this kind of technology?
Well, within the United States, for human applications like the cancer therapies, or even more science fiction-y in the future, the germline editing for embryos, the relevant authority is the Food and Drug Administration. The manipulations, the genetic manipulations of the cells, turn them into a regulated, what they call a regulated article. And it means that you have to get permission before you can even try doing clinical trials. And the clinical trials are also overseen by local ethics advisory boards. And only when you've done enough trials and shown enough safety and effectiveness will the FDA hear a request to now be able to sell it on the market. Other countries tend to have a similar system. What we don't have is a single global government that says all countries must follow the same rules. So we're likely to see some variations, especially with the things that involve human reproduction, where the cultural attitudes vary tremendously from country to country.
We're talking to Adam Bolt, director and writer of the new documentary Human Nature, and Alta Charo, professor of law and bioethics at UW Law School, talking about the new documentary and the ethics and the technology and the potential for CRISPR, this gene editing technology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the story of CRISPR and its potential uses? What questions do you have? Do you have concerns about it or hopes about it to cure potential diseases, maybe for you or someone in your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with Adam Bolt, filmmaker behind the new documentary Human Nature, and Alta Charo, professor of law and bioethics at UW Law School. She's featured in that documentary. We're talking about the gene editing technology of CRISPR, what it can do, what it might do in the future, and concerns about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you heard about potential uses of the CRISPR gene editing technology? Do you think there needs to be careful regulation and thought about how it gets used? Have you seen this documentary yet? It has aired some already. And do you have questions about how all this stuff works, what we can do with it, what we could do with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Adam, a point that's made right at the outset in the documentary, you go back to an older scientific speech, putting this in perspective. By in the human scale and the global scale, this is incredibly new. I mean, theory of evolution was just in the 1800s. Genetics came a while after that. This is just like an eye blink in human history, this huge change. Did you get that sense from the scientists you talked to?
What was interesting to me, you referenced that clip that we started with, which is Robert Sinsheimer speaking in the mid-1960s. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he was asking them the same questions that we're asking now. Mm. Which is, you know, where is this all headed? And, you know, in some ways we've come a long way since the 1960s. And as we've been talking about, CRISPR makes things easier, makes things faster, makes some things possible that weren't possible before. But at the same time, there's so much we still don't know. There's so much we're still not capable of. So, yeah, we definitely wanted people to kind of take in this more far-reaching perspective on human history and where this kind of change might fit into it.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Minocqua. Jay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Jay?
I have a question for Professor Alta Charo, and that is, given the complexity as we look into the future, should there be some sort of oversight body in addition to the FDA, particularly given that there has been some significant controversy about the FDA's objectivity with respect to the vaccine and the pandemic?
Well, first, by way of transparency, I should tell you that I used to work at the FDA. So to some extent, they're still my guys. So I'm rooting for them. I think that the FDA is certainly not the only part of the regulatory picture, and that's as it should be. They're there to look at safety and effectiveness. That's it. They're not there to make moral judgments about what is good or bad for society. That happens at the political level, at the state level, state laws that sometimes make this research illegal or fund it, at the federal level, where, again, they can either ban it or they can fund it or they can let it be legal but not provide money for it. And these are all political choices that are made. And at that point, you bring in the whole apparatus of democracy to help figure out whether or not you want certain applications to be permitted.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jay, at 800-642-1234. Adam, I want to get into something that Alta was talking about earlier. We think mostly when we think about genetic editing about humans, she was talking about agriculture. Can you share some of what you came across in creating this documentary when it came to genetics and non-human species?
Yeah, well, we talk a little bit in the film about some of the possibilities to use CRISPR to change both agricultural species and in some cases wild species to better adapt them to the changes that we're seeing in our climate. So, for example, we have a scientist at Syngenta, which is based in North Carolina, a company that's jumped on the CRISPR bandwagon and creating corn that has a change that allows it to tolerate drought and absorb moisture and retain moisture better. We also talk a little bit about a project that's in the very, very early stages looking at coral bleaching, which is this problem where as the water gets warmer, these algae that live inside the coral and give the coral nutrients get expelled in the warm water, and it causes the coral to die. And they're looking at ways that maybe they can actually alter the DNA of the coral to adapt it to these warmer temperatures. So there's a lot of, on the cultural side, that's where genetic engineering, that's where all the action really was until fairly recently, and that's certainly going to continue. And then we have this whole new possibility opening up of perhaps considering changes to just wild species in nature to protect them.
Also, can you talk about the ethics of that some? Because I know even with existing forms of genetically modified plants, for example, there are concerns about unintended consequences. We can't always know if we make genetic changes in a species, how it's going to work in the wild. What kind of concerns does that raise?
Well, there's been a lot of concern about the ecosystem being disturbed. If you were to alter a particular plant or an insect, what are the ripple effects down the line? And it's for that reason that there's also research going on very actively to look at how you can control changes, how you can reverse changes, how you can make other changes that will basically balance out the ones that you made, so that you build in a set of safeguard techniques that allow you to take more risks. I've got neighbors down the street who have a trampoline. Trampolines are often very, very dangerous, but they put a net around the whole thing, and it made it a lot safer for the kids so that the kids could jump higher. And that's pretty much what we're trying to do, or what the scientists are trying to do with CRISPR. And particularly when they use it not to make a permanent change, but to make temporary changes, something called epigenetics, which is reversible. And that really adds a whole new layer of safety when it comes to your concern about unintended effects on the ecosystem.
Talking to Alta Charo from UW Law School, bioethicist there, and Adam Bolt, creator of the new documentary Human Nature, looking at genetic editing technology, CRISPR in particular, its potential and concerns it's raised. Adam, one of the chapters of your documentary is called Playing God, and you looked into some theological concerns people had about this. What kind of things did you hear along those lines?
Well, actually, I would say a couple of our chapters, one is called Playing God, one is called Brave New World. We kind of wanted to investigate and in some cases poke a little bit of fun at these tropes that exist, that you always hear about, especially about biotechnology. In the film, we don't get that deeply into the theological debate. I mean, as Alta said earlier, there are a lot of different views across cultures and religions about reproduction and when life begins and, what kind of limits we should place on this technology. But a big thing that we wanted to remind people of is the ways that humans have been, quote unquote, playing God for millennia. And we use the example of agriculture going back 10,000 years or more to the domestication of crops and livestock, and what an enormous change that represented in the history of life on Earth, which, you could kind of argue that the first farmers were, in a sense, the first genetic engineers. Obviously agriculture has changed the whole planet, huge swaths of the planet are now given over to crops and animals. So this isn't the first time that humans, through curiosity, through wanting to change their environment, have embarked on something that might be called playing God.
And Alta, last time you joined us on this show, it was talking about a chapter that gets told in the documentary, a Chinese researcher who had gone ahead and made some edits in human embryos. In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about the idea that, okay, we might have all the great policies and rules in the works. What about somebody going rogue like that in some ways and doing things that maybe the rest of the world doesn't want to see happen?
Well, the reality is that you can't have 100% control, and there will always be the risk of rogue actors. We see that no matter how strong our criminal laws are, you still have people manage to be criminals. But right now, among other efforts, the World Health Organization has an advisory committee, again, transparency, I'm on this thing, which is looking at global governance options to strengthen the ability of countries to help one another govern it. And it includes looking at the possibility of creating some kind of so-called whistleblower mechanism, a place that scientists can go when they have a hint that there may be something going on that's not very good, not responsible, and a place where they can go and talk about it and maybe have, you know, a small group address this by, you know, reaching out to the person who's perceived as a rogue and try to catch these things before they get too far. It's turning out to be very tricky, but we're actively looking at ways we might accomplish that.
Alta, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
That was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Adam, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Alta Charo is a professor of law and bioethics at UW Law School. She's featured in the new documentary Human Nature. She talked to us about the ethical questions surrounding gene editing. And Adam Bolt is the director and writer of that documentary, Human Nature. You can catch it on PBS's science series Nova next Tuesday, September 15th at 7 and 11 p.m. on PBS Wisconsin, or tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on Milwaukee PBS. Also check it out on PBS streaming platforms. Coming up after the news, we'll find out what newly released documents tell us about how employers have been reporting workplace injuries, or in many cases, not reporting them despite federal requirements. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new recordings released yesterday reveal that President Trump knew that the COVID-19 outbreak could be serious and deadly as early as February. We'll talk about the recordings and what they could mean for the election. First, thousands of workplaces across the U.S. haven't been reporting employee injuries and illnesses to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which has been a requirement since 2016. It's according to documents obtained through legal action by Reveal after the Department of Labor had refused to release them. In addition to failures to report injuries, penalties have been small for companies that haven't complied. Jennifer Gollin is a reporter covering labor and corporate accountability for the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal. She broke the story. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
Can you talk about the documents we're talking about, these things that came out of the Obama administration requiring this reporting on a workplace illness and injury?
Right. Well, starting with the 2016 data, under an Obama-era rule, larger workplaces were required to submit these so-called injury and illness records, these 300A forms, they're called. And these forms require employers to track the number of injuries and deaths that they have in a given year for each work site and then submit them to the government. So the idea was that the federal government could then start imposing, you know, a targeted enforcement program, and these records would inform that effort.
Right, because OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, you write, they've got a very small number of inspectors relative to the number of companies. These could be kind of red flags to tell them where they need to go, right?
That's right. So they just have 800, so there are just 862 federal inspectors covering millions of workplaces. That was as of January 1st of this year. So OSHA needs to use its resources really judiciously and target its enforcement in dangerous industries and workplaces using these records.
And part two of this is OSHA can use it, but if I understand this correctly, these are supposed to be publicly available documents. Do I have that right?
That's right. So under this Obama era rule, the idea was that all of this information would be posted on a public-facing website. So people could go in, members of the public, workers themselves, and understand which workplaces were dangerous compared to industry averages and whether they were safe on the job each day. But that all changed after Trump was elected.
Right. So all these businesses are supposed to report. All of us are supposed to have access to it. What ended up happening?
Well, so after Donald Trump was elected president, OSHA officials said that while employers still had to report that information, they wouldn't make that data public. So I had filed a Freedom of Information request requesting this data.
And it took a while. Talk us through that process.
It took a while. Initially, the agency refused to provide this data to us. And they cited law enforcement exemptions, saying that this information would be used in the course of investigations and so on. So we filed a lawsuit as a result to get a hold of these documents.
And what did you find ultimately when you finally were able to see these documents? Were companies actually filing like they were supposed to?
Well, we found that a lot of companies actually didn't even submit their data. So we got a full set of data for 2016 and some records for 2017. And we found that only about 60% of the establishments that were supposed to submit their 2016 data actually responded. So and the next 2 years weren't any better. Just in 2017 and 2018, less than half of the workplaces that were required to report actually did so.
Was there any kind of punishment, I guess, if companies didn't actually file these reports?
Only a tiny portion of employers that failed to submit these reports were actually penalized by OSHA. We requested this information, and as of the middle of last month, OSHA had only issued about 259 citations carrying fines of just over $127,000 to employers that failed to submit this data. So what this shows is that there's very few consequences for employers that fail to file.
Talking to Jennifer Gollin from the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal, talking about a requirement that many businesses submit these injury and illness forms to the federal government. Her finding a lot of them don't, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of punishment for not doing this. Jennifer, in the results you were able to get access to from 2016 and those companies that did respond, what kind of things did we learn about these workplaces?
Well, what we learned is there are actually some very large Fortune 500 companies that failed to report this data. We found that Home Depot appeared to be missing entirely from the data, and only one establishment with 58 employees appeared for Boeing. So I think what this shows is that there's a real compliance issue that's stymieing this requirement that OSHA collects this data. And the problem with this is that it makes it difficult for the public to understand which workplaces are safe and which workplaces are putting their workers in danger. I worked with my colleague, Melissa Lewis, on the data analysis, and she went through and crunched the data under a tight deadline so we could turn the story around for the public. And basically, OSHA, until now, until the release of these records, has really left the public in the dark. There has been no way to assess which workplaces are safe.
If I'm an employee at one of these companies that's supposed to file this report, again, on injuries and illness and deaths, for that matter, on the job, am I supposed to have access to that? Can I get a look at it?
Yes, under federal law, you are required, your employer is required to release these records to you if you request them. And they are, some employers have tried to only release a portion of the records for when the employee was employed by that worksite. But that's not part of the rules. You as an employee, you have a right to request all of these files, these OSHA 300As, and understand how many injuries there are in that workplace and how many deaths. Really what this does is it allows workers and members of the public and researchers to calculate a rate for that worksite and understand whether how it compares to an overall industry rate for a particular industry.
Were you able to get any reports from employees at companies directly and compare and contrast with what ended up coming through to OSHA?
Well, this has been really central to some of Reveal's past reporting. A colleague of mine, Will Evans, has done some terrific groundbreaking work around injury records for some of Amazon's warehouses that he collected through current and former employees, showing that the injury rates for some of the sites that he looked at were above the industry average. He also has looked at Tesla's internal records. And I myself, previous to that, had looked at injury records that I obtained from various sources and FOIAs to show that a major Navy shipbuilder had altered a power tool, basically ignoring the manufacturer's warnings, and created what company executives themselves called a widowmaker that maimed and injured dozens of workers. So these records are absolutely instrumental for researchers, reporters, and members of the public and workers to use to assess whether work sites are actually complying with federal workplace safety standards and protecting their workers as they should.
One question that pops into my head is, are companies, even when they do report, using consistent standards? So if company A has lots of reported injuries and company B doesn't, does that mean company A is dangerous, or does it mean company A is diligent and they're actually filling out every incident and maybe company B isn't?
Well, there have been cases where companies are known not to report injuries, or they send people home, or say that it was an injury that didn't occur in the workplace. This is a starting place, and it at least allows for members of the public to then go get more information on how companies are accounting for injuries and deaths and whether they're using a transparent and accurate approach when accounting for injuries and deaths on the job.
In our last minute or so, this is injuries and illness. Now, your reporting goes up to 2019. 2020, we've got COVID-19. Is this report something that could be, if people actually fill it out, a data source for the spread of COVID in the workplace?
Well, OSHA has failed so far to issue any specific standards that would limit infection among workers since the start of the pandemic. So while OSHA recently posted, in part as a result of our FOIA and that of other organizations, including Public Citizen, which filed a parallel suit for some of these OSHA 300A forms, OSHA recently posted data through 2018, but there's no 2019 data there. So that is something that we're looking for answers on, and we'd like to track down that data. I think it's important for members of the public, whether there is a specific standard relating to COVID or not, it's really important that the public have access to this information so they can start to have some of the fundamental data that they would need to then go and ask more questions.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Jennifer Gollin is a reporter covering labor and corporate accountability for the Center for Investigative Reporting and Reveal. She talked with us about newly released documents that show thousands of employers around the country have been ignoring a rule that requires them to report workplace injuries to the U.S. Department of Labor. Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about the news that President Trump knew how deadly the novel coronavirus was and why he downplayed its seriousness. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 6, Joshua Powell was number 2 at the NRA. He's a lifelong gun advocate, but he's now turning against one of the country's most powerful organizations. He explains why today on 1A Plus. That's at 6 today on the Ideas Network. First, since early spring, the United States and the rest of the world has been dealing with the outbreak of the deadly novel coronavirus. In the early months of the pandemic, President Trump downplayed the severity of COVID-19. He argued that once the summer months settled in, the heat would kill the virus and it would disappear, and he compared the disease to the annual cold and flu season. But recordings released yesterday of an interview between the president and veteran journalist Bob Woodward reveal that Trump knew how dangerous the virus was as early as February.
It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus. You know, people don't realize we lose 25,000, 30,000 people a year here. Who would ever think that, right?
I know.
It's pretty amazing. And then I say, well, is that the same thing? This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
Since the recordings were made public, people have criticized the president for not doing more earlier to stop or slow the spread of the virus, which so far has killed roughly 190,000 people in the United States. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of multiple books on political science, including as co-author Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Well, what was your reaction to this news yesterday? Not just news, but the tape of the president talking about the deadliness of this virus, as we heard, while publicly downplaying it.
Well, I guess I was surprised when I first read about this in the Woodward book yesterday, that not only did the president sort of articulate an understanding of the deadliness of the disease, but also the way that it was transmitted. I didn't even understand at the time, I think, how much the aerosol transmission was the most problematic part of the transmission of COVID-19. So I think I was surprised not only that he had been briefed this extensively, but he sort of understood it and reiterated that in the questioning from Bob Woodward.
And the discrepancy between what he's saying there in this one-on-one interview with what he said in the public, we don't really have a lot of compare and contrast here. We haven't had a disease like this in over 100 years. But what do you make of that that discrepancy between what he's saying there and the message he was sending the public at the time and since?
And I guess, you know, this is where we often turn to our political leaders to, you know, sort of give us information and provide leadership for what we, the public, should do. And the fact that he understood this, but then was giving sort of contradictory information to the public, I think is problematic, in part because, again, this is about the spread of the disease and how to protect against it. And you know, in the early days of the disease, many of us didn't know how it worked. And so it would have been better to have a president who, you know, was explaining this is how it moves, this is, you know, what we understand about it. You know, when diseases are new or less clearly understood, it's a time when, you know, sort of people also get panicked. And I can also remember this from like the AIDS crisis in the 80s. You didn't always have initially clarity on how that was moving through populations and how it was transmitted. But it seemed that the president did know how this was being transmitted, but didn't necessarily share all of that information with the public.
I want to give a listen to another piece of that recorded interview. Bob Woodward here talking to the president, and the president saying he wanted to downplay the virus. This is on March 19th.
Give me a moment of talking to somebody, going through this with Fauci or somebody who kind of it caused a pivot in your mind, because it's clear just from what's on the public record that you went through a pivot on this to, oh my God, the gravity is almost inexplicable and unexplainable.
Well, I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you...
Sure, I want you to
I
be.
Wanted to... I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
And that's what the president has pointed to, his defenders have pointed to in the last day that he was playing it down to not create a panic. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I mean, I understand not wanting to create a panic, but at the same time, we have a deadly disease that is making its way through the population. And oftentimes, the more information that the people have so as to protect ourselves against it, the better. And that also seems to be in conflict with some of the policies that the president then went on to advocate in terms of like reopening businesses and schools and so forth.
We're talking to political scientist Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha about the president's recorded comments, released a new book from Bob Woodward. Lily, when it comes to political response to this, whether it's going to affect, say, the presidential race, a lot of big news has been happening over the last year, and not much of it seems to move the polls a lot. Do you see this being any different?
I'm not sure I would see this as being any different, in part because we're 6 months into the coronavirus, and while this is kind of a sort of notable information about the early days of the coronavirus, we still have 190,000 Americans who have passed away from COVID-19. And as my colleagues in political science have noted, the polls have been remarkably steady. Not only in the last 6 months, but during the entirety of Donald Trump's administration.
And we can't rewind history and see what might have been different. But critics of the president are saying if he had conveyed some of the sense of urgency to the public that he shared in that interview, people might have taken social distancing or mask wearing more seriously. Is there a case you expect to be made from Democrats in particular that this was a life or death mistake?
I'm sure that the campaigns will be making that argument, in part because they've been making the argument with regard to the president and the administration's, to some degree, mishandling of the COVID crisis in general. So this just continues to contribute to that overall argument that's being made not only by the Biden campaign, but by campaigns sort of for other offices as well, with regard to the president's handling of COVID-19. And again, given the polling on this, the general consensus is that the president has not handled the COVID-19 that well. And so Democrats see this as an opening in general, and obviously with this new information in particular, to continue to make that point.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of multiple books on political science, including Mad Men in Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America. She joined us today to talk about the revelations about President Trump's knowledge about the severity and risk associated with the COVID-19 outbreak and what this could mean for his first term and his reelection bid. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there is help out there for people at risk of suicide and for their loved ones. An expert joins the show to talk about the scope of the problem and the services available to the people who need them. Also, we'll get a preview of the Milwaukee Film Festival with a focus on bridging racial disparities, and we'll find out how to join the event online this year. And are you in charge of your own kitchen for the first time, or do you know someone who is? We'll get great advice on setting up a starter kitchen, and you can share your questions and suggestions with us. You can get started right now. Share your questions and your must-haves over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A few weeks back, travel writer Rick Steves joined the show. He's been finding ways to enjoy life even when travel is off the table. One of the things he's been doing with his non-travel time, pulling out his old trumpet, relearning how to play it, and entertaining his neighborhood with mini concerts. Turns out Rick Steves is not the only person picking up an instrument during the pandemic. Some of the most famous guitar companies in all the land, Fender, Gibson, and more, are reporting record sales this year. New York Times quotes the head of the Fender company saying it will be the biggest year of sales volume in Fender history, record days of double-digit growth, e-commerce sales, and beginner gear sales. On top of that, creators of online instructional guitar videos have been getting a lot more views over the last 6 months or so. According to the piece in the New York Times, a lot of the sales are being driven by 20-somethings and teens and by an increasing number of women getting into guitars as well. I've definitely been getting into my saxophone, piano, and poor drumming a little extra during the pandemic. I have tried to play guitar from time to time in the past with poor results. All in all, I am in favor of this big increase in guitar activity in the world. But please, if you're learning or teaching guitar, try to find a good variety of instructional music so we're not all hearing the same three chords again and again and again. This is Central Time.